Good luck, everyone, and thank you very much for coming. It's a little challenging trying to, it's a little daunting task trying to keep people up so late at night. So I very much appreciate the opportunity. I feel like I'm back home again, and thank you, Rob, for welcoming our children with open arms and for being such a wonderful advocate for Yitzhibur. The idea came to me, the idea for the topic of 12 Steps to Tshuva came to me last week. David had called me and asked if I would consider coming to say a few words before Slichas. And it so happened in the last 2 weeks I've been involved in placing two from young men in detox and rehab facilities for substance abuse. And they were both in their high 20s, and they had, you know, unfortunately gone south into addiction, heavy-duty drug use. And one of the people called me, a friend of one of the addicts called me and asked me for some information about treatment facilities, what would be a good place, is it a good investment, do they work, how does it go? So I gave him a quick primer. I told him what an enabler is and how it works, codependency, the basic terms of addiction. And he asked me, so how does this work? So I explained to him what a 12-step program is. And a 12-step program is actually, millions, literally millions of addicts worldwide have used it since the early 1900s. The basic premise of it is that the addicts who are committed to changing go through a series of 12 steps where they commit to changing and trying to get their lives back together. And as I was listening to myself tell this man about the 12 steps, you know, it's the season of tshuva, I said, hey, that sounds very familiar. And when David spoke to me a few hours later, for a second time, I said, you know, that would be an interesting topic. What can we learn from people who extract themselves from the horrible tragedy of addiction? We know with any similarities, we were first. The Rambam wrote his Tshuva 700 years beforehand. So, and it's clear if you read through the steps and how it works, you see clearly that they had drawn from the notion of effective tshuva and how it works. We know, I mean, very briefly, the Rambam and others list the components of tshuva, and what they did is really the Rambam took it an abstract theory of tshuva. Tshuva means to feel sorry, to return, to change, to do better, and which is really a very abstract thought, and he codified it. He said, here's what you got to do. There are steps to the process. You have to have charata ala avar. You have to feel bad for what happened before. You have kabbalah ala asid. Have a kabbalah for the future to make up your mind that things are really going to be different this time. And vidui, and to actually speak the chataim that we do, which is why in Yom Kippur, really Rosh Hashanah is really more about making the Kaddish Baruch Hu our king. And Yom Kippur is more about tshuva, but throughout the process, throughout the days of Elul, and we have Al Chet, and we go through the different chatam, and we commit ourselves to try to do them better. So I guess in the broader sense, you would say, what can we learn from this process? See, one of the things that addicts have, and I've been dealing, have to deal with situations like this, but I hope I've been of help to people who were struggling with addiction over the years. I'm certainly not an expert in the field. I had the chutz to speak over the last few days in preparation for this talk. I spoke to four or five people who have really devoted their lives to this, and 2 hours ago, Dr. Abraham Tversky of Shia, who's a Teaneck resident, was kind enough to give me some time from Yerushalayim to share his thoughts, and I'll be sharing some of them with you. But the the notion of, see, with an addict, it's very, very real. Their lives are in danger. They know that if they slip, they die. Which, and we, it's obviously, it's a very different dynamic. We have to motivate ourselves to try to get better and to motivate ourselves for the Yemei HaDin. And what can we learn in preparation? I'm going to go through a number of thoughts that I'd like to share. Number one is this issue of urgency. And the klal, one of the major rules in addiction is that people don't get better until they hit rock bottom. And it's just an ironclad rule. And the idea is that rock bottom means the person doesn't start getting better until they absolutely understand in their gut, in their mind, and everything around them tells them that there is no way. They've hit shal tachtis, as we say. They've hit the bottom, and they must get their lives together. And just a few stories came to mind, and I'll add one that Dr. Tversky just told me. I remember the very first time that I spoke to Dr. Tversky about addiction about 20 years ago. He shared with me the story, which brings home the point of how powerful this is, and what a horrible net an addict gets sucked into. He said that in discussions with he was leading the discussion of people who are suffering from addiction, and the process is that if people talk, you introduce yourself. Hi, I'm Yaakov Horowitz, and I'm an addict. And then they go for it's part of the bracing the process of admitting the reality at hand. So then they talk about their experiences. So one of the people there, Dr. Tversky mentioned to me that one of the people there was saying, he was speaking about how difficult it was and what a hard time he has. And then the second person spoke and said about his experiences and how he was struggling. So the second fellow turns to the first person and he says, What's your problem? You've been clean for 15 years now. What are you saying? It's so hard for you. You're clean for 15 years. So the other guy turns back to him, and he says, "You're clean for 15 years. I'm only clean for 6 months. You know how much harder it is for me?" So the other fellow says, "It's true that I'm clean for 15 years, but," he says, "I'm an early riser." He says, "I get up at 5 in the morning. You don't get up till 7 o'clock. He says, "I'm fighting 2 hours more than you are today." And it just brings home the point that after all those years, it's a fresh struggle every single day for someone who's chemical, who's dependent on substances to get through the day or to enable them to move forward. I had a fellow who shared with me recently that he had an architect, an extremely talented fellow, lives in Pennsylvania, an extremely talented young man. He was actually 70, and at age 30, he lost everything: his family, his house, his career. And he rebuilt his life, and for 40 years he went to meetings every single day. And he still, Adayoyim, goes, that's the power of addiction. Dr. Tversky just shared with me now, and this really relates. I asked him, I said, "So how do we feel?" I asked him some very practical questions. I said, "Dr. Tversky, an addict knows his life is in danger. How do we feel that we prepare for the Yemei HaDin? And we want to change. Change is so difficult. And how do we get this feeling of urgency, so to speak?" Baruch Hashem, our lives, we all would love to see improvement in our ruchnias and our gashmias and our interpersonal relationships. How do we feel the sense of urgency? So Dr. Tversky says that the rock bottom that they talk about in addiction is not it's not an exact science. It's really up to the person. And what it means is, it doesn't mean that a person is literally in life-threatening danger, which the literal translation of rock bottom is, but it really depends on when they're ready to change. And he says, for every person it's different, and so when some people feel that it's time for them to change, that's when they're ready. He mentioned to me that he had a fellow who came in, and he said this guy lost his, which is unfortunately very typical. He was stealing money to support his habit, and his wife left him. He lost his children, he lost his job, he lost his house, he lost his car. He came to Dr. Twersky. After one day, he bolted. After one day in the program, he left. And he came back 2 years later. He came back to the program 2 years later to start again. So he walked in. He says, "Doctor, I'm sure you're angry at me that I left you last time I started the program, and I left after a day." So he says, "No, you're always welcome here." He says, "But tell me, what motivated you to come now?" So he said that a year ago he realized that a pint of his blood, Dr. Twersky just told me this a half hour ago, a pint of his blood was 16 beers. That he had gone from one thing to another and was selling his blood literally at a blood bank, and was getting, he figured, and that didn't break him yet. But he realized when he was successful, then he said, he said he was running the United Way Drive. When he was in his good old days, he ran the United Way Drive for the whole community, and he raised thousands and thousands of dollars, and now he was panhandling for quarters, and that broke him, and he was ready to change, and he got better. But it's a subjective thing. He says, I think the takeaway from there was that we have to look at ourselves, try to see to it what we can do to improve ourselves. And once we realize that there's a midah that we want to change, once we realize that we would like to daven better, once we realize that we would like to try to see to it that even in spending more time with our children or spending more time with our families or being a better parent or being a better a child to our parents, being a better sibling, when we're ready, we're ready. The issue of honesty is also something that we find is very bracing and very, very important to the process. There's a fascinating verse from the Lublina Rav as we understand this whole interaction that we have with our Yetzer Hara. We know that Yaakov and Esav are the typical situation between Tov and Ra. We generally see the battle, the wrestling match between Yaakov and Esav, and the fact that they were twins and the fact that they were born together just lets us know all the more so that we're bound together with our Yetzer Hara, and we're bound together with the dark side, so to speak, of our existence, and we try to do battle. So Lublin Rav says, if you look at the story of Yaakov and Esav, what happened was, it says that they were wrestling, and they were fighting by Yovek Hishimai Adalai Tashachar until the morning. So Vayayovek, they made dust, so to speak. So it should say that they wrestled. There are other ways to express themselves in terms of wrestling. Why Vayayovek means they brought up dust. Why is that the... And also it says over there that he got him in the morning. They waited until the morning. And he said, Shacheni ki Ola Hashachar. He pinned him. Yaakov pinned Esav. So in the analogy, it would say that he defeated him. Yaakov defeated, he won. He defeated Esav. So he said, Shacheni ki Ola Hashachar, send me, it's morning time, time to go, let me, release me, please. So Chazal tell us that Yaakov told him, "Were you afraid of the dark? You're a ganav, you're a thief, that you're afraid of the dark." So he says, "No, it's time for me to sing Shira. From the time I was created, I never had the opportunity to sing to HaKadosh Baruch Hu until this moment. And now that I have the time to sing Shira, I have to go. I'm a school principal, Rabbi say. I'm a school principal." That sounds exactly what you hear in the hallway. Right? You stop a child, he's doing something, he's someplace where he shouldn't be. I tell him, "Listen to me, come, Yossi, Morty, come into my office, let's talk about it. Rabbi, I gotta go, we're getting Shia right now." Right? "I'm sorry, Rabbi, I'd love to talk to you now, but, you know, sorry, gotta go. Shia, I'm gonna miss the last Gemara, you know." So it sounds like, we know Malachim can't lie. Malachim say the truth, so it must have been true that he couldn't have sang Shira until that moment. So what's that all about? What's the dust, and what's all this about? So if you had a job description for the Yetzer Hara, what would that be? What would it look like if you stopped the Yetzer Hara in the street and said, "What do you do for a living?" You met him in Starbucks, and you say, "Tell me, what do you do?" what would the job description be? So typically you would say Yetzer Hara is someone who gets people to sin. So the Lubliner Rav Meir Shapiro says that the Yetzer Hara, we should look at it differently. The Yetzer Hara is a sparring partner. Just like you go on a treadmill, or you go on a ellipsis, or you know, literally a sparring partner in boxing. The purpose of that other person is to make you stronger. So he says that the Yetzer Hara is there to test the person so that he can be defeated. And you know, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky used to always say that people just like we were given tzitzis at 3 years old, so we get this little pair, you know, this little small little pair of kid tzitzis with the decorations on it. Rabbi Yaakov used to say, as you get older, you know, you need a larger size. So he just talked about understanding the parsha. He used to say, as we grow in years, we should understand the parsha and the stories that we learned in Maimara Tzipora. You know, we should understand it on a more adult level. Our understanding of the parsha should grow with us. So the understanding here is that the Yetzer Hara is meant to make a person stronger. And the Lina Rav says that when does a malach is given a shlichus, he's given a job. The malach goes out and is given a task back to the Shvarchu. When he's finished the task, he comes back and he gets a new job. When Yaakov defeated the Sar Shel Esav, when he defeated the angel, when he defeated the Malach, he had accomplished his purpose. The Malach did his job by testing Yaakov and having been defeated. Once he was defeated, he fulfilled his shlichus, so he had to go back to Hashem. He fulfilled his job, so he went back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And so it was true, of course, when the morning came and the darkness, that's the lashon of avak, of dust, is that it brings clouds. The Yetzer Hara tries to cloud us to our sense of emes and understanding of what we're really wired for, of what our purpose in life is, and the fact that we're supposed to be devoting ourselves as much as we can to Dvarim Ruchniyim. To matters that get us closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I saw a very nice part a few weeks ago. It says, Re'eya Noisi Noisi Nosnechem Hayayim Etzachayim Etzatayim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I have placed before you Etzachayim Etzatayim Etzamavis Etzara. Hashem said, I give you choice. We know that Hashem part of, and the Rambam brings it as part of the process of tshuva, and part of understanding tshuva is to understand and believe that we have full choice. Because if we didn't have full choice, how could we be punished for things we do wrong, and how could we get schar for mitzvahs that we do? So the question is, why is the term re'iya used? The Sfasemis mentioning a few things here from the Sfasemis. I had the schus to learn for a few years with a chavrus of mine. So he says as follows, what's the Lashon Re'iyah? And in English we also use this. You can be talking to someone on the phone and you say, don't you see what I'm saying? The person doesn't see you. The term Re'iyah is used not necessarily for seeing, but more for understanding. So what's the Lashon Re'iyah? So he says, the Sfasama says, that sometimes you see something, you have already seen something in the past. You see something that let's say you're familiar with a certain object. You saw a certain statue, or you see a friend of yours that you recognize. You see a certain car. You see a certain ornament. And you know what it looks like when the lights are on and it's clear. And you see it in the distance and it's twilight and you can't really, then you see it a second time later in a situation where you don't have such clarity. So the Sfasemis explains that when you see it, if you've already seen it before, in a second, that re'iya, that look, and that understanding of what you've seen automatically brings you back to the understanding that hey, that's it. And therefore, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, re'eya noichi noichi masnechem ayon, when I see before, when you see in front of me, as a chayim, as a toiv, you see both good and bad in front of you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, that we are wired, our neshama is wired to be closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Our neshama is wired to seek this which is good in this world, and to be able to devote ourselves to Ruchnius, to spirituality, to Torah, to Avodah, to Yerushalayim. And therefore, Hashem is telling you, see, notice what's there. You've been programmed in advance. You've been programmed to see this. Therefore, it's something that you should recognize automatically. And he brings a term, in an understanding of the term Bittul. When Avram Avinu, the very first journey that Kadosh Baruch Hu goes to Avram Avinu, and he says, Lech lecha mi'artzecha mi'meladetecha mi'beisavicha la'aret asher areka. Kadosh Baruch Hu tells Avram Avinu, leave your home, leave the comfort of your home, and come to la'aret asher areka, come to the land that I will show you. So Rashi says he didn't tell him where he was going. Rashi says, why didn't he tell him, I'm going to take you to the land of Eretz Yisrael? Why did he just couch it, so to speak, and say, I'm going to take you to a place, without telling him where it was? So Rashi says that he wanted to make it more chashuv. He wanted to make it more pleasant, more enjoyable, more exotic. You know, you get a gift, so if you wrap it up in a nice package, it's more entertaining, it's nicer, it adds to the cachet of it. So therefore, that's one reason, Rashi says, that Hashem wanted to make it to be a chavav abeinu. By not telling him the land that he was going to, he would make it more chashuv to him. And he says another reason is to give him schar for each and every mitzvah. So each time that he would tell him something, he would get another reward for following Hashem's command. So the Sfasemis explains that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted him, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted Avram to be zocher, but he uses terms there that are not that clear. One of these days I've been wanting to do this for a long time, to write a sefer, a book, explaining these esoteric terms like Bittul and Ein Sof, and you read a lot of Chassidus Sfarim, Klippas or other things. They speak about certain terms that, like, we kind of understand them, but it's really hard to get your hands around them. And so he uses two of them there. The Sfasemis explains that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted Avram Avinu to be zayche to Ein Sof. Ein Sof means infinity, to the infinite. He wanted him to be zayche to Ein Sof. He should merit the opportunity to touch infinity, whatever that means, Ein Sof. And you can only arrive at that stage through Bittul. These are the two words that he uses there. So that's why he said, Lech lecha mi'artzecha mi'meladetecha mi'beisavicha, I want you to come, I want you to be zocher to Ein Sof, and I want you to, you can only do this through Bittul. What does Bittul mean? What would you use for a term? An English word for Bittul would be?
Nullify,
right? Negate. Self-effacement, right? You would say Bittul means a good musa say that you'd say, I'm Bittul. What does that mean? I'm nothing, right? I'm a nobody. That's the purpose of, one would think often, you know, the term of a musa term is to, who am I, right? To a sense of humility. How does it help you serve Hashem if you're nothing? There's got to be more to understanding than that. So my chavrusa said, it offered a very interesting insight. If you have a pot of soup, a fleishike soup, okay, it's a meat soup, there's chicken in it, and a drop of milk falls into it. So we have a rule in halacha that it's batel b'shishim, okay, the milk becomes batel, this term bittel, 1 in 60. So if you have 60 ounces of liquid and half an ounce of milk falls into it, it's bottle. What happened to that milk? It didn't become nothing. It became soup. The milk became soup. It didn't become zero. It didn't disappear. It's still there. When you say something is bottle, it doesn't mean that there's nothing there. It means that it's something, it became absorbed in something larger than it was until now. And the term, when someone says, buckle, the proper or a way, a positive way of looking at the term bittul, rather than saying it's a negation of oneself, it says the person becomes part of something larger than themselves. When someone joins Hatzalah, when someone joins the army, someone joins the volunteer fire department, someone joins the board of the yeshiva, what happens at the moment is the person becomes not only themselves, their unit, so to speak, they become absorbed into something larger. It becomes something more than their existence was until then. And that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was telling Avraham Avinu. I want you to leave where you are now, and I want you to become batul to me. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was telling him, I want you to leave this finite existence that you have, and I want you to, how can you be zocheh to Ein Sof? People are finite. We only live a certain length of time. We can only jump so far and run so fast. Our bodies are finite. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I want you to become part of me. I want you, by becoming mizdabek, as we say, to attach themselves to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is our job, of course, during these Yimei Harachamim, during these days of Slichas and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, to try to refresh ourselves and re-energize ourselves to go back to the Re'iyah that we saw once about becoming part of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of becoming batel, as it were, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's existence. And therefore, one could also say that another understanding of this, that why he didn't tell him where he was going, is if you go from point A to point B, you came here for slichas, but someone stops you, someone calls you at whatever it was, a 11:45, and say, where are you going? I'm on my way to slichas. Okay, you're going home? Where am I? I'm heading back home. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to the gym. So you're heading from point A to point B. If somebody asks you, where are you? You say, exactly, I'm going there, I'm coming from, okay? If you find a friend of yours, if you go for a walk with your spouse, you go for a walk with a child, with a good friend, someone says, where are you going? You don't say, I'm going to the park. You say, I'm going for a walk. What's point B? Doesn't make a difference. It doesn't make a difference. Where you're going is irrelevant if the purpose of your walk is to spend time with someone you love. And that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was telling Avraham Avinu. I want you to come with me. Where are you going to? El Aretz Asher Areka, the land that I will show you. Why didn't he tell him where it was? What difference does it make? Hashem was telling Avraham, I want you to come with me. And this is the struggle and the day-to-day distractions of our lives, the day-to-day things that we do that bring us joy, the things that we do that we do because we have to do, all of these things together, naturally, and it's understandable, pulls us away from the focus, from our spiritual focus, from our ruchnistic focus, to try to learn and to daven and to devote ourselves to our families the way we would like to. And it is this sense of focus, the real focus in the world of sports they call it mental toughness, right? What distinguishes the average ball players from the real stars? Yeah, they always talk about a certain mental toughness. A friend of mine was very close to, he lived in a smaller community, and was one of the basketball stars there. He was very good friends with. So he used to go to the gym and to the stadium and there basketball and shoot around with, he was feeding him foul shots. And he said the guy drained like 50, 60 in a row. So he says, why can't you do it why can't you do this during the game? He says, you got 20,000 people looking at you and screaming. He says, here in the gym, it's nothing. I said, there's a certain mental toughness that you have to focus on the task at hand. And again, life tends to distract us. So my friend says that the term of Ein Sof. He gives a beautiful example. He says, imagine if you were out walking and you go to the Canadian Rockies for a few days, and it's obviously the scenery is gorgeous, it's beautiful, you have the scent of the forest, and you're looking around and you see these majestic mountains with snow on top of them, and you see the water, the turquoise color of the streams there, and when you're walking around, you just capture it all. Because imagine if you lost your keys. Imagine if you lost your keys. You're walking on the same path, but you lost your keys. You have your key to a hotel room, you have your wallet there with your ID, you're not going to be able to get back home. Now, you're taking the same path, but now you're looking for your keys, you're looking for your wallet. What you've done is you've taken an Ein Sof. We've taken an infinite experience that where all our senses would tingle with the beauty of nature, and you've reduced all of it to looking for a pair of keys. And this is really our challenge in life. Our challenge in life is we wind up in so many ways, all of us, we wind up looking for our keys when we should be looking for all of it. And the Yemei HaDin really are times where we try to refocus and reboot ourselves. I think, you know, if you look at the Chassidus Shasharim, they always talk about these, wagon drivers and, you know, this guy who owned the inn with the Chassidus Shasharim, all the stories are about that. That was their life then. So we need to give a BlackBerry analogy. Okay, we need to do a hard reset. My iPad crashed last week. So I went to Apple Store, returned it to the factory settings. Okay, that's what these days are about. What are these days about? What are these Yemei HaDin about? We try to restore ourselves to our factory settings, where we came from, what our tachlis in life is, and what we try to do. And really, this is really what it's all about. My understanding is there's a halacha that a king had to write a sefer Torah. One of the mitzvahs that a king had to do was he had to write a sefer Torah. So there's a very interesting machlokes. Chazal tell us that there's supposed to be two sefer Torah. One they put away in a vault. One they put away in the Beis Genuzos, and the second one he carried around with him all the time. So typically, the sefer Torah, one of them he got the Yerusha. If he was the son of a previous king, so he had one as an inheritance, and the second one he had to write himself. What happens if he doesn't have a Yerusha? For some reason, he didn't get the one from the previous king. So the Rishonim, some say that he has to write two, put one away and take one with him. And some say he doesn't. If there's no other one, he could just write one and keep it with himself. So I would like to, you know, I said you use Mishalom, you use the analogies from our daily lives. So I'm a school principal. I'll give you one about taking notes. You know, you're always fortunate. There were a couple of kids in the class who always took good notes. You always copied from them, right? So way before, I'm dating myself, before photostat machines became, you had to do it by hand, right? So what happened? One kid takes the notes, second kid takes from him, right? By the time the fourth kid or fifth kid is copying from a copy, so you say, what does this mean? Which, by the way, lahavdil is why we have so many gersois in our Gemaras. Well, whenever you see on the side, they check the gersois because they were written by hand. That's what they did there. They wrote things by hand, or they did it orally. So you always lose something, you know, you lose something in the transmission. So every once in a while, they have to go back. They have to go back to the original. Say, hold on a second, who started with those notes? Whose notes were they originally? And you go back and you see, okay, let me see, is the text that I have correct? My understanding of the Sefer Torah was the same thing. You know, starting another presidential election season, right? Everybody gets up there and they have these goals and dreams, and they talk about what they're going to do, and then you know what happens. They get elected, and they have to start wheeling and dealing. So the king, the melech, started, this is my understanding of what these two Sefer Torah represent. The king started with a set of dreams. Everybody always starts idealistically. Every organization started with fabulous unions, started with an amazing... The union movement started with a beautiful goal. People were being abused by business owners. So they got together and they said, we're not going to do this anymore. Communism started with a great idea. You know, no more one village owner where everybody owns. So all of these things started with great ideas. What happens over time, this is just the nature of the human experience, is that things start out with a certain sense of idealism, and over the course of time, things very often turn south, and we have to refresh. You have to go back and look at your mission statement. So I think that this is what it represents. The king had a Sefer Torah that he started with that was fresh when he took office. He put it away. That was the original copy. Then he took one with him. He went out to battle. He had to adjudicate arguments between people. He had to send people to die. He had to do really tough things and difficult things. And just like you do a blackberry, another blackberry muscle, right? You have your hot sink, right? You have your PC at home. You go out for on a 3-day business trip. You come back, you hot sink. You see, let's get all the addresses and the cat. Let's get everything updated. So he had to go back and look at it and say, what did I became a king? What did I become a king for? I became a king with certain vision in mind, with certain goals. And that had to be the basic move of it. It had to be in a place where he could access it and see the original. My Tony Dem always used to ask, when you learn Hilchos Aseret Yemei Teshuva and these Yemei Rachmim that we're just starting now, isn't it dishonest? Says in Halacha that Aseret Yemei Teshuva, we should take chumras that we don't take all year round. If we do, let's say, some Pas Yisrael, one example that's given. If you do certain things that when we do certain things that halachically are certainly okay, but there are opportunities to be machmir that we don't do all year. So during Aseret Yemei Teshuva, it's appropriate to take things that you don't do all year. Doesn't that look a little... So like the boy says, hey, what are you, fooling Hashem? What's the deal? Hashem knows the truth. Like, he knows that you're not going to do this. And he says, which the implication is that even if you're going to go back and do the same thing you did before, you should still do it. So I always give them a visiting day analogy. Right? You go away to sleepaway camp. That's what I tell my Talmidim. If you go to sleepaway camp, remember? You go to sleepaway camp, for example. You know, your parents come up on visiting day. I can guarantee you that the tens of thousands of parents who visited their children on visiting day, not one of them has any thought in their mind that the bunk looks like this all summer long. Everybody walks in there, they know exactly what happened the night before. We were all kids once here. You squeeze out half the tube of toothpaste, you put the soap in a... You put it overnight in a cup of water so it should be real. So, oh, Mom, I'm all out of toothpaste. Look, there's nothing left, you know. Okay, we all know the deal. We all know the drill. We've all done it. If not this, we did something like it, or somebody did it. Somebody in the bunk did it, right? You're smiling. Is that what you do? Right? We all know this. It's a spiel, so to speak. So why do we do it? So one thing is, you know, have a little respect for your parents. You know they're coming. So, you know, it's not wrong to shut. Another way of looking at it is, at least you should see once what it's supposed to look like. Okay, we don't do this all the time. But once, at least a few times a summer, at least you should get a picture of what a bunk should look like. You say the same thing. It's interesting that same, this notion of trying to improve ourselves, even if it's something that we can't attain, we can't live with all year, because life gets in the way, and we don't have the hunger that an addict has, because Baruch Hashem our life, Baruch Hashem our Mesudar. So we don't have that you know, the notion of looking and striving for that hunger in our belly that we know we have to change. We just, that's the mice, it's not like, but there's supposed to be a sense of perfection that we should strive for. One of the things, if you look at the, by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, at Bereshis, at the beginning, right at the beginning when HaKadosh Baruch Hu made the world, it says, Bereshis bara Elokim es ha-shamayim v'sa'aretz. We know that Elokim means din. Elokim is a harsh, a firm, a no-nonsense term. Elokim. And Hashem denotes rachamim, mercy, kindness. I remember one time that, you know, the Gemara says that you learn your most from your Talmidim, because it happens to be one of the 12 steps, is that one of the 12 steps for addicts is that they're supposed to have a sponsor, and that they're supposed to talk to somebody else, because one of the underpinnings of the whole addiction thing is that you have to, when you say it, anything that you say to somebody else, you have to really know well yourself. The Gemara says that you learn most from your Talmidim. You can fool yourself sometimes. You're learning a piece of Gemara. Yeah, I got it. Let's go. When somebody asks you questions, right, you have to get it more clearly. So I remember a Talmud when I was asking Rebbe, he says, Rebbe, why does Hashem need so many names? I was explaining to Gemara that the Shin Dalet Yud and Elokim and Hashem. But Rebbe, why does Hashem need so many names? I have one name. Well, why does Hashem need all those names? It's a good question. It's a pretty good question, right? What do you answer? So I don't know, just Baruch Hashem, Hashem was kind in that. I said, parents do different things for children. You buy them stuff, you put away money for their education, you send them to camp, you do things that are kind to them. You also are heavy, right? Baruch Hashem, my wife and I are zaycha to be at grandparent stage. Grandparents are all rachman. That's one of the luxuries of being, Yirat Hashem, you'll get there. You'll all get there. Yirat Hashem. Grandparents, it's the nachas of being a grandparent, is that you get to be all rachamim. Almost all rachamim. So why does Hashem need all these things? So I tell my Talmud that parents do different things for you. But when you look at your parents' face, you know exactly what which hat they're wearing at that moment. Right? When you speak to your children, we always used to do, when you say the second name, then you know you mean business. That's one good way of doing it. Baruch Yehuda Har. Right? You say the second name, you know that's business. We have one of our daughters only has one name, so we added a name. Better name to her. You know, it's like it's another way of saying, okay, this is it right now. Now we mean business. So I said, when a parent, you look at their face and you hear the inflection, you hear the tone of their voice, you know the Midas Adin hat is on right now. And when you see that smile, you know, so I said, you can't see Hashem. Since you can't see God, he has to have different names, so you should know which hat Kav Yaakov Hashem is wearing, what they're doing at this time. So, in any event, by Bereshis, it says, Bereshis Bara Elokim. Elokim, Midas Adin, made the world. So Rashi says that Hashem's original thought process was that it should be all din. Someone does an Aveira, they get punished immediately, that second. So it says, Hashem saw that people can't exist like this. We're frail human beings. The world's going to end. If we get punished every time we do something wrong, the world's going to end. So Hashem shafa, Hashem partnered din with rachamim. Hashem partnered din with rachamim. It's interesting, if you look, the first time that the name Hashem appears is when humans were created. Because we're all fantastic parents when our kids aren't there. Right? We're all great parents. And when life gets in the way, that's what happens. So Rashi says again, the way Rashi's understanding is that the original machshava was din, and then Hashem changed it, so to speak. What does this mean, Hashem changed his mind, and like, how did this work, and what was it? So a flip shot that says as follows, that when you start something, there has to be a plan for perfection. A building is built, you plan a business, you write a business plan. You plan an event, you make a simcha. So you have a schedule. write a business plan. You know, you have it all in your head exactly what it's going to look like. But when you make that plan, you know it's not going to be like that. When you make a schedule for a simcha, you're planning a bar mitzvah or you're planning a wedding, you have a schedule. You know when you make that schedule, you know it's not going to be exactly the way you have. You're going to have to adjust on the fly. The other interpretation is that Hashem made the world, HaKadosh Baruch Hu made the world Elokim. The plan was a perfect plan, but Hashem knew all along that there's going to have to be a little bit different than Rashi Chat, that there's always going to have to be a balance of Rachman later on. And this is our job in the Yemei HaDin, in these days, as we prepare to enter these Yemei HaRachman, and we daven that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should give us a year of chesed, a year of hatzlacha, a year of nachas. We daven that when we say chadish remenu kikedem, one of the most poignant feelings, we say chadish remenu kikedem. What does it mean? It means reboot us, please. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, get us back to factory settings. Get us back to the idealism of our youth. Get us back to that original machshava that when we were younger, you know, I do admissions, and we're starting admissions in my yeshiva now for next year. I have been fortunate enough to interview hundreds of talmidim for our yeshiva. Nobody comes to the yeshiva and says, we have such a mediocre son. Everybody comes in, and that's what they're supposed to feel. Right? Nobody brings the children to a bris and says, I hope this will be a nice average kid. You know, you're supposed to want the best. That's the way it's supposed to be. I'm telling you, maybe it's just my yeshiva, but I doubt it. You know, my talmidim, they're all the 3-year-olds. They're doing calculus already, and you know they say a little joke there. They say somebody went to Chassidus Rebbe. He says, Rebbe, my son, I don't know, he has the neshama of one of the neviim. He walks around the house. He picks up string. He wraps it around his hands like tefillin. You know, I never saw this. A kid 3 years old. He sees a little box. He puts it on his head. Must be such a son. So the Rebbe tells him, in Yiddish, hey buddy, why don't you go to Minyan more often? So, you know, we all go to with these aspirations. We have aspirations for ourselves. We have aspirations for our children. But it's supposed to be like that. It's supposed to be like that. The parent comes to an interview and tells me his kid's constrained. So I say, what? The danger is when we insist on perfection. We're supposed to be mizdabek in the midas of Hashem. If we raise only with Elokim, it's a recipe for disaster. That's the balance that we try to find in our lives. To strive for the best, but to make accommodations. And during the Yemei HaDin, as we enter these Yemei HaDin, it's a worthwhile tefillah that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should be kind to us and accept our flaws, and we should try on our part to deal with honesty and integrity, to try to look at ourselves, to try to establish what it is that we could possibly do better for the coming year. And we ask that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should accept our tefillahs berachmim uveratzon. I'm going to close with a story. I heard at Aguda Convention a number of years ago that was really made an incredible, I think of it, incredible impact on me. Every Erev Yom Kippur, there are a few things that I read and do, and this is one of the stories that always comes to mind. A fellow related a story of an individual in Eretz Yisrael who was a Chayta B'tshuva. He grew up non-observant, and he spent some time in the fast lane, and he was going to the mikveh Erev Yom Kippur. So he had a number of tattoos from his previous life, and he covered himself with a towel that, you know, he didn't want anybody to see. As he approached, the towel fell, and the guy was never embarrassed. He didn't know where to hide. You know, all his tattoos were on display for people to see. The story goes that a Holocaust survivor, an elderly gentleman who had lived through the war, saw this man's embarrassment, and he came forward And he told him in Yiddish, he says, he showed him his numbers on his hand, and he says, "This is from my Gehenim. This is from my Gehenim, from my previous hell in Europe and during the Holocaust." He says, this is from your Gehenim. This is from mine. Kim Lomuzgain. He says, "Let's go Teufel together and prepare for Yom Kippur. Set aside our past and set aside the stuff of life, and let's prepare and purify ourselves for the Yimei Hadin." So we ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu should usher in a year of Shalom in Eretz Yisrael and all of our own needs. And we should desire to try to refresh ourselves with the idealism of our youth. And the Rebbeinu Shlom should bench us with a Ksivach Sima Taiva and a Gritka Bench Jar, and Hashem should be Mamali all Mashallah Sudeinu Taiva. Thank you very much. A Gritka Bench Jar.